I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com. Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Computer Works and Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. Joining us now, John Harrison Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Well, after two nights of debate watching, the first night I felt pretty good. Last night, Thursday night, didn't feel so good. Kind of felt like, oh, I can see a glide path for Donald Trump. Your thoughts?
Oh, look, it's June of the year before the presidential election. I think that what we have seen both nights, although they were incredibly different debate nights, was really the initial stage of the campaign. This is the point where candidates who are frontrunners try to secure their position, who are mid-level candidates try to move up, and who are on the fringe try to get enough notice to be, you know, kind of in the game. And I think if we sense it in any different way, we run the risk of overanalyzing the circumstance we're in. Now, I understand where you're going. You're saying, I won't put words in your mouth. I'll let you say it in a sec. But I understand that, you know, in this stage, there is a sort of a battle for purity, you know, sometimes.
Oof.
Messaging and that. But I would suggest to you that we have seen that in many senses, where people turned around and won elections.
Right.
And Trump's glide path is already well-defined. Remember, whoever is nominated, even if it is John Hickenlooper from Colorado, he's going to call the person a socialist. Right? That's a given. And straight on down the line.
Yeah. To me, it isn't even as much about the socialism thing. It's just who can outdo each other with basically saying we should have an open border, I think is a problem. I think it is a problem when you start talking about gun confiscation. I think it is a problem when the major point of the evening was the poignant moment of the evening was someone hammering the front runner over busing. First of all, most people don't think about busing anymore, but I view it as an abject failure. That is not the way to go after Donald Trump. Let me play you this moment with Kamala Harris, Senator Kamala Harris from California, and Joe Biden.
We have to make continuing education available for everyone so that everyone can compete in the 21st century. We're not doing that now.
Senator,
as the youngest guy on the stage, I feel like I probably ought to contribute to the generational conversation.
As part of Joe's generation.
No, I'm all
before,
for
part of Joe's generation. Okay. Let me respond.
Before we move
the
on
issue,
from
if I may say, is not generational.
Let's, please. Yeah.
The
Senator
issue
Sanders,
is not
let
generational.
You,
the issue is who has the guts
comment,
to take on Wall Street, to take on the fossil fuel industry, to take on the big money interests who have unbelievable influence over the economic and political life of this country.
These issues
that
have been better
issue.
Senator Harris,
Marianne,
Senator Harris, I'm so sorry. We will let all of you speak. Senator Harris. Senator Harris.
Please,
we will let you all speak. Senator Harris.
You can't afford to wait for evolution on these issues.
Okay, guys, you know what? America does not want to witness a food fight. They want to know how we're going to put food on their table.
Well, that wasn't the clip I was going to play, but it's a good one to talk about. She was clearly prepared for that line. That didn't just pop in her head.
Well, with all due respect, she came prepared for every line.
Right?
And she's a prosecutor. So, you know what they do, right? A good prosecutor or a good defense lawyer. They prepare and they have, they're ready. They actually, outline the whole thing and look at possible trajectories and look at what they want to say, what they need to say, and clearly also, that cacophony there summed up the challenge with this debate, right? You had gotten a little bit into the debate. They started with the question to Sanders, which was interesting, not to Biden, but to Sanders. And for the first, like, 15 minutes of the debate, maybe 20 minutes of the debate, it was, I may be overestimating that, but it was essentially, it was really a Sanders-framed debate. They were talking about, you know, Medicare for All, they were talking about all sorts of stuff. And at a certain point, I think a number of the candidates realized that this thing was going a certain direction, and they wanted to alter that direction. And they all exploded at the same time. The weird part about it was that that was where Harris's prosecutorial skills came in. She recognized the cacophony, right? And then she stayed silent until everybody had screamed so much that they needed to take a breath, right? And then she whomps. It was a skillful performance, and it is one of the reasons why I think most people say, you know, that it was her night.
Here's the clip I was talking about.
Sure.
Campaign, and I'm going to now direct this at President Biden. I do not believe you are a racist, and I agree with you when you commit yourself to the importance of finding common ground. But I also believe, and it's personal, and it was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race in this country. And it was not only that, but you also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
It's a mischaracterization of my position across the board. I did not praise racists. That is not true, number one. Number two, if we want to have this campaign litigated on who supports civil rights and whether I did or not, I'm happy to do that. I was a public defender. I didn't become a prosecutor. I came out and I left a good law firm to become a public defender when in fact, my city was in flames because of the assassination of Dr. King.
Do you agree today that you were wrong to oppose busing in America then?
No,
do you agree?
I did not oppose busing in America. What I opposed is busing ordered by the Department of Education. That's what I opposed.
All right, there you go. Now, that's an abbreviated portion of that clip, but tell me what you think.
Well, I mean, she clearly came prepared to do that. And that was interesting because right off the bat, it proved almost all the pundits wrong, right? I think everybody was looking for a potential Sanders-Biden clash or, assuming one of the candidates who are sort of in the third tier might go after, you know, particularly Hickenlooper after Sanders, stuff like that. I don't think a lot of people anticipated that Harris was going to come in with a direct assault on Biden, with something that was clearly intended to challenge Biden in his front-runner status. It was a very politically savvy move for Harris, and she did two things that were really smart. Number one, she went to a recent news item, this issue of Biden talking about working with desegregationists. Number two, she personalized it. She described, you know, she put herself into the storyline. It was very effective. Now, what's interesting about it is you can debate the issues involved, right? You can debate busing. You can debate Biden working with other senators at different times in history. You can debate all that, and you can agree with Biden or Harris, whatever. Here's what's most telling about it, most striking to me. After everything that's happened over the last 2 weeks, Biden was not prepared for that challenge. response to it was exceptionally defensive, and frankly, he went into detail, so much detail, that he got lost there and ultimately shut himself down. And it was an alarm bell.
Well, boy, you know, you've got, in his defense, though.
Yeah.
He's debating an African-American woman.
I understand.
Who clearly faced some forms of discrimination as a child, yelling at a woman that you know, went to an integrated school. Because I thought busing was a bad way to achieve integration, okay? Right? But I would find it very difficult to yell at an African-American woman who rode the bus to a school that became integrated. That's a really tough spot to be in.
And he shouldn't have yelled. But what he should have done is listen to the whole of what she said, take it all in, and A, recognize it, say, that's a powerful statement and an important one. Now, let me respond here as best I can. And then he should have said, I came up out of Delaware, a state that really wrestled with a lot of these issues. I came into Washington as one of 100 senators, the youngest person elected to the Senate in modern times. I tried to advance civil rights causes that were close to my heart, that drew me into politics initially. And in that time, we compromised, we struggled. I got some things right, I got some things wrong, I grew. And by 2008, after many, many years in the Senate with a long record, Barack Hussein Obama looked to me to be his running mate because he said to me, I know how to get things done in Washington, even in a deeply divided Washington. And I think we got some incredible things done.
I think what you're saying is that he shouldn't have litigated it like a lawyer, debating in a courtroom, even though she was certainly using some of her skills as a prosecutor. Joe Biden is Joe Biden at his best when he is emotional, when he is sort of romantically speaks about things. Yeah,
right.
Okay, uses his charm.
Did you notice at a certain point, I think I'm right about this, that he went after her saying, I became a public defender, you became a prosecutor, right? And okay, if you really want to go there, right, then you don't just say that. Then you go deeper with it. And again, it's not, I don't think you start yelling or attacking or something like that. You say, I became a public defender because I recognized the system wasn't fair. And I wanted to stand with my legal education at the side of people who were being harmed by it.
That's
where my heart is. To say something like that.
There are a lot of people on the sidelines right now that have not picked anyone. And as I watched Facebook last night, a large number of female legislators, they were really, they've not all endorsed Kamala Harris. They were really excited after last night.
Oh, look, I mean, this is the thing. If you want to analyze what happened last night, from a political standpoint, if you, it's sort of like Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. If you really want to talk about weather, I'll talk about weather here. If you really want to talk about politics, the significance of last night is that, yes, it did weaken Biden. That may well help Bernie Sanders. And it may help Harris and Cory Booker to some extent, depending on whether you break loose some of Biden's very, very strong support among African Americans. But another person who may have gotten harmed last night was Elizabeth Warren, because I think that there's very little question that in the last couple weeks, maybe a couple months, Warren has really been rising. If you look at the polling data, there's pretty good evidence that she's been rising at the expense of Harris and some of the other candidates. Now, after a very good debate performance, I thought, on Wednesday night, Warren comes into a situation where she should be solidifying her status as somebody who's front runners. But now you've got another candidate, Harris, who I think will potentially draw some people away from Warren. reshuffled the dynamic, and I was somebody was asking me what I think is going to happen, you know, coming out of these two debates. Here's my sense. I think we're about to see a bunching of the candidates, i.e., we're about to see Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Harris really start to bunch up at a closer level, right? And, interestingly enough, that may actually be good for some of the next tier of candidates, because when those front runners start to bunch up, what that means is that they all go down. You know, they get out of the 30s, you know, all kind of bunching.
Well, let me just say, it's good for either Jill Karoski or Ed Falone. Because the longer this thing plays out, you know, Wisconsin just might matter.
I could not agree with you more. I think that that what you saw there was a circumstance where a lot of the nonsense of May and early June was laid to rest.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll take a break there. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated, Madison Firefighters Local 311, and Madison Teamsters Local 695. John Nichols from the Capital Times with us. All right, let's continue with the debate. Obviously, being a mayor is not easy, because the buck really does stop with you. You know, the buck never stops with Donald Trump, but when something bad happens in a city, a mayor has to deal with it. So Pete Buttigieg has been dealing with this for this police shooting the last couple weeks. Here's what he said.
In South Bend is now 6% black in a city that is 26% black. Why has that not improved over your two terms as mayor?
Because I couldn't get it done. I could walk you through all of the things that we have done as a community, all of the steps that we took, from bias training to de-escalation, but it didn't save the life of Eric Logan. And until we move policing out from the shadow of systemic racism, whatever this particular incident teaches us, we will be left with the bigger problem of the fact that there's a wall of mistrust.
I think that the question they're asking in South Bend, I think in cities across the country, is why has it taken so long?
Look, we've taken so many steps toward police accountability that, you know, the FOP just denounced me for too much accountability. We're obviously not there yet. And I accept responsibility for that, because I'm in charge.
If the policy, you should fire the chief.
So under Indiana law, this will be investigated, and there will be accountability for the officer involved.
But you're the mayor. You should fire the chief if that's the policy and someone died.
What was that? That's Eric Swalwell. What was that?
You know, I mean, look, that was Swalwell trying to...
You know, pardon my language, but that was kind of a dick move.
Well, it's also Swalwell trying to be the John Delaney of Thursday night.
John Delaney.
You know, John Delaney. Guy on Wednesday night wanted to answer every question in every way he could, any way to get attention. And that's where Swalwell's at. I mean, he was trying to you know, be heard on everything and trying to say blunt things. The problem for him in that case was he didn't identify where he was coming from there. He didn't say, well, I believe he was a prosecutor, if I'm not mistaken, or at least he's got some legal background.
Yes, he was a prosecutor.
Yeah, and if he'd said that and he kind of put it in context, come in with a little bit, but just, you should fire the chief, right?
Well, he was tone deaf, because Buttigieg was showing some contrition. He was showing,
exactly.
So you don't pounce on somebody at that moment.
And also when they're saying, look, I'm being criticized by my police union for demanding too much accountability, and then you say, well, you haven't demanded enough. Perhaps that's right. But again, you know, you have to, you know, you respect the contrition, which I thought was rather a remarkable thing in an American political debate, a guy saying, I didn't get it right. You know, that's substantial. But B, you kind of take a breath And that's one of the problems when you have 10 candidates on the stage, right? If somebody takes a breath, somebody else yells something. And so, yeah.
It was overshadowed, but I thought Pete Buttigieg had a good night. I thought Kirsten Gillibrand had a relatively good night.
I thought she had a terrific night.
Yeah.
She was, whenever it came to her, she was poised, firm, smart, everything you expected her to be. You know, if you know her politics, she's actually, I have always expected that she was going to be a very good debater, that she was going to play an important role. But it was interesting because she really had, I will suggest, senatorial kind of style there. When it came to her, she was ready, and she had, you know, framework, ideas, good sense. There was one fascinating point, right, where they went down the line and they asked everybody to say, well, you aren't going to get everything you want, so what's the one thing you're going to work on? And if you noticed, Gillibrand offered a family bill of rights that had some real good details in it, and then Harris was next to her, and Harris was like, I like that. You know what I mean? Her response, which is very human and very good,
yeah,
was to celebrate what Gillibrand said.
Well, you know, but Harris did that after Eric Swalwell put this proposal out there.
This field of candidates, you have a unique position on gun reform. You're proposing that the government should buy back every assault weapon in America, and it should be mandatory. How do you envision that working, especially in states where gun rights are a strong flashpoint?
Keep your pistols, keep your rifles, keep your shotguns, but we can take the most dangerous weapons from the most dangerous people. We have the NRA on the ropes because of the moms, because of the Brady Group, because of Giffords, because of March for Our Lives. But I'm the only candidate on this stage calling for a ban and buyback of every single assault weapon in America. I've seen the plans of the other candidates here. They would all leave 15 million assault weapons in our communities. They wouldn't do a single thing to save a single life in Parkland. I'll approach this issue as a prosecutor. I'll approach it as the only person on this stage who has voted and passed background checks, but also as a parent of a generation who sends our children to school where we look at what they're wearing so we can remember it in case we have to identify them later. A generation who has seen thousands of black children killed in our streets, and a generation who goes to the theater and we actually look where the fire exits are. We don't have to live this way. We must be a country who loves our children more than we love our guns.
Senator Sanders, a Vermont...
So, the NRA is going to raise a lot. The NRA needs all the help that they can get. They're kind of in a difficult... Yeah. That's just a non-starter. Gun confiscation, which is what that is, because it would be mandatory, that isn't going to sell to the American people.
The problem with all of this is that at the end of the day, people do want a response to guns. And they want something that is strong and bold. But it also has got to be something that's politically saleable and that doesn't, you know, sort of become a... you know, like a slogan for the NRA and for others, right? They're coming for your guns. Now, Swalwell tried to address that when he said, you know, you can keep your pistol, you can keep your rifle, things like that. That's, you know, he was kind of working into the zone. But, you know, again, one of the things you want to do on the gun debate is figure out how you win it, because it's too important to... people's lives, to people's values, all sorts of things, to kind of set up a situation where you actually sort of lose the ground that you gained. And so I'm not sure that Swalwell was particularly doing a good job there.
So we aren't really covering much from the first debate. I thought Warren had a strong close. Tim Ryan was in that debate.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim Ryan is... talking about some things that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama debated, and they were trying to be, each were trying to be the bigger friend of blue-collar workers in 2008. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
Remember?
I remember the Ohio fight.
Right?
I remember covering the hell out
of
it because of the trade issues.
Right. So here's Tim Ryan the other night.
You just referred to him, promised that manufacturing jobs were all coming back to places like your home state of Ohio. Can you make that same promise?
Yes, I believe you can. But first, let's say the president came. He said, don't sell your house to people in Youngstown, Ohio. And in his administration, just in the last 2 years, we lost $4,000 jobs at a General Motors facility. That rippled throughout our community. General Motors got a tax cut. General Motors got a bailout. And then they have the audacity to move a new car that they're going to produce to Mexico. I've had family members that have to unbolt a machine from the factory floor, put it in a box, and ship it to China. My area where I come from in Northeast Ohio, this issue we're talking about here, it's been going on 40 years. This is not a new phenomenon in the United States of America. The bottom 60% haven't seen a raise since 1980. Meanwhile, the top 1% control 90% of the wealth. We need an industrial policy saying we're going to dominate building electric vehicles. There's going to be 30 million made in the next 10 years. I want half of them made in the United States. I want to dominate the solar industry.
Manufacture
those here in the United States.
Senator Warren.
All right. How do you think that's playing, and is that going to have any saliency this year?
I think it may. I thought that, by the way, was an outstanding answer. And, you know, it's not something you and I haven't heard, but I think there's a good possibility it's something that a lot of people, you know, outside of the zone where you and I talk a lot about these trade issues and a lot about this, you know, sort of the politics of all this, that reference to people unbolting machines, right, that they've worked on.
Mm-hmm. Well, much like the workers at Sensata and Freeport.
Yeah, up in Ashland. I know that there were stories like that some years back, I think, in the paper industry. And so that's powerful stuff, and it really connects to people in a real sense. I think that, I'll be very blunt with you, I think Ryan's running for vice president, right? And he's running for vice president as a sort of, alternative to Sherrod Brown. You and I have talked a lot about Sherrod Brown. First and foremost, that I wish he had run for president. I think he'd be very, very good in these debates. But he isn't running for president. And he holds a Senate seat, and there's some people who say, oh, he shouldn't give up a Senate seat, blah, blah, blah. I think Ryan got into this presidential race, I'll be very blunt here, with the idea that he would do well in debates, make a name for himself, and then be somebody who got considered as a prospect for vice president. And frankly, what do you think about that appeal? Don't you think that if, let's say, Kamala Harris is the nominee, or
Elizabeth Warren, yeah,
and you put Tim Ryan on that ticket, and you basically say, Tim, you are never going to see Florida. With all due respect, you're not going to Florida. And frankly, to be honest, you're probably not going to see much of Arizona, but you are going to see a lot of Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, maybe North Carolina, because
Minnesota,
because, and maybe even a couple other spots too.
Eastern Iowa,
yeah. Exactly. Missouri, right? Because if you do this right, you get to be vice president of the United States, and once you're vice president, we'll let you go to Florida.
All right. Finally, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you about the debate between Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke. What did you make of that?
Do you mean the Texas Senate debate?
Yeah, the Texas Senate debate.
No, I mean, it was...
But the arcane language that they were using back and forth about immigration law.
No, it was important. If we were at a conference of immigration law specialists, or frankly, with a lot of people who sincerely care about immigration law, as I do, it's an important distinction, and they were going at it, and I appreciate it on an intellectual level. From a standpoint of the debate, I have to be honest with you. I think Julian Castro, by the way, had the upper hand and did very, very well in the debate on a whole bunch of levels. But from a standpoint of the debate, I think when they were doing that, much as when Tulsi Gabbard and Ryan were going at each other about Afghanistan, my sense is that Elizabeth Warren probably just sat back and said, yeah, I'll just let them talk.
By the way, Tulsi was the most Googled candidate from the first debate.
And she should have been, because the fact of the matter is, while Tulsi Gabbard has people criticize her on a number of issues, and, there's a lot to talk about there, the bottom line is that what she said about war and peace,
mm-hmm.
and about presidential responsibility.
It was pretty poignant.
Wars of whim, frankly, in many cases, was incredibly powerful. And I would say this. I was stunned that the second debate did not go deeper into some of these issues, and I was disappointed because my sense is that Bernie Sanders would have talked a lot about this in the second debate, and we need a lot more discussion of this, and so more power to the people that are checking out what Gabbard said, because it's an important part of our discourse.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliesOffice.com.
SliesOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.